Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for joining us, everyone. It's a gray, drizzly night here in the desert, which is kind of a perfect fitting backdrop for what we'll do and the places we'll go over the next 4 hours. We're headed down some dark and gloomy paths, some true life tales, every bit as eerie and unsettling as some of the wilder topics we tackle here each night. If I were to ask you, what's the most corrupt place in the United States? Some of you might say Washington, a lot of money floating around there. Others might say Chicago. I would argue Las Vegas doesn't need to take a backseat to any other city in that category. But I'll tell you, as a destination, Louisiana is in a category all its own. You've seen it in countless movies. You know, the scene is there's moss on the trees, bodies in the swamp, pot-bellied cops chewing on toothpicks, taking money under the table. I've spent some time in Louisiana. I loved it. I love the place, love the people there, and can imagine what a great place it would be for an investigative reporter because it would be such a target-rich environment, kind of like Las Vegas is for reporters. In this hour, we will explore a dark and disturbing story set in the Pelican State, a murder mystery. It's the story of the Jeff Davis Eight. Eight women, all of them murdered in the same parish, which is a jurisdiction. Most of us would call it a county. In Louisiana, it's a parish. They all knew each other. Some were related. All had personal histories that included some really bad decisions, drugs, booze, prostitution, and petty crime. But none of them deserved to be murdered, their bodies tossed in canals or fields or woods. The crimes have never been solved, officially, that is, but it doesn't mean the identities of the killers are unknown. Looming over the actual murders themselves, the corrupt and bloodied hands of the police, and just maybe some higher-ups, much higher-ups. It's an amazing tale, as compiled by a courageous reporter, author, private investigator named Ethan Brown, whose own life has been threatened multiple times as he compiled the evidence that went into this book. It's called Murder in the Bayou. It's a spellbinding piece of work, a story I know you're going to want to hear. Then in the second half tonight, a different kind of hell, the purgatory born of good intentions. It's a story about hundreds of well-intentioned, big-hearted people, smart, educated, some of them very well off, all united by a quest for enlightenment of sorts, but who came under the spell of a charismatic teacher who, over time, morphed into something else altogether. In time, the disciples of this guru came to realize they were trapped in a cult that forced them to cut off the world, cut off their loved ones, forced them to endure harsh and humiliating changes in their own lives, that is, until it all came crashing down. The story, their stories, are told in a new multi-part TV series called How I Created a Cult. And the series includes a revelatory interview, a recent interview with the leader of this cult, a guru gone astray named Andrew Cohen. Two of the people who put the series together will join us, producer-director Megan Gibson and psychotherapist Alex Howard. It's a seductive and scary journey into what sure sounds like something akin to madness. That's in the second half of tonight's program. Webmaster Lax and I have put together our usual assortment of oddities and news items culled from various media around the world. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website on the page about tonight's program. Included are a couple of stories that I think fit the mood and the subject matter this evening, including an update on the so-called Highway of Tears. It's a serial murder case up north, the story about dozens of missing or murdered women. Authorities are now saying this case may never be solved. Also, a story about a different kind of crime, a shocking con job in the world of high-priced wine. It's a pretty entertaining tale. And tonight, a report about a bizarre outbreak of hallucinations. I think the first example is in Oregon, but there are other examples in this story as well. And some ideas about how this kind of imagery can spread from person to person, almost like it's an invisible mental virus. Those stories and more in the NAPS News section tonight. While you're on the Coast website, you can check out how to become a Coast Insider. You know, it's still a great deal. It's pennies a day. You get to listen to this program whenever you want, as many times as you want, on many of your devices, and you can access a vast archive of previous guests and programs. It is a great deal. Plus, there's a link there for how you can subscribe to George Norrie's television show, Beyond Belief. Check it out when you get a moment. With that, let's assume the position, folks. Bring in the dog and cat, and maybe for tonight's program, lock the door behind them. Put on a pot of Joe. Slip into those jammies and bunny loafers, slide into that easy chair, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Murder in the Bayou. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. The story of the Jeff Davis 8 is rich and twisted. It's a labyrinth of treachery and corruption, politics, drugs, murder. With a cast of characters so distinct, you might think a screenwriter had created them. But the story and the characters are all too real. 8 women murdered. Most likely there are more murders related to the cover-up of what went down in the parish, this parish in Louisiana. Putting this book together about the murders and the investigation, or maybe lack thereof, was no easy feat, and a lot of people didn't want to see the book ever get published. Its author, Ethan Brown, was told he would never live to see it happen. But he did. The book is out. Ethan Brown is here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Man, what an amazing piece of work, Ethan. I would imagine you're not finished either. It seems like this story will be with you for the rest of your life, or at least your professional life.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I appreciate the kind words about it. In a much larger sense, obviously this isn't finished, because all 8 of the murders are unsolved, right? It's something I've worked on for about 5 years on and off. And there is a sense that, this is not the end of the story.
Is it the kind of thing where you're never going to let it go until you see justice done, or some of the people who are culpable, not only the ones who actually did the crimes, but the other people who are involved, brought to justice?
Yeah, I mean, that's fair to say, this is a much larger issue, but it's very hard to envision what justice might look like in this case for a number of reasons.
Well, tell me. Well, maybe we'll get into that as you tell the story. Yeah. Well, let's set the scene first. Sure. Where is Jeff Davis Parish? Describe sort of life there, the setting, the reputation of this place. I know in your book you mentioned it's the Boudin capital. I didn't know what that was,
right?
But go ahead.
Right. So imagine Louisiana, which we all know, and imagine New Orleans, which is probably the most well-known place in Louisiana. So New Orleans is on sort of the eastern part of the state. All the way to the west, getting close to Texas, is Jeff Davis Parish. So it's literally on the other side of the state from New Orleans. It's about 3.5 hours from New Orleans. New Orleans, as I'm sure folks know, is a fairly mid-sized to large city. Jeff Davis Parish is a very, very small parish of about 30,000 people in the entire parish. The parish seat, Jennings, which is where this case takes place, is even smaller. It's about 10 to 11,000 residents. It's a town that is obviously small, It's very, very split between its north and south sides. Its north side looks like a very typical small town that you'd see anywhere in the south or the Midwest. There's sort of a handful of car dealerships. There's a public library. There's a courthouse. Very quiet. There's a few sort of historic buildings sprinkled in there to make it look somewhat pretty. But then when you cross the railroad tracks, you actually literally go to the other side of the tracks, you are in South Jennings. And in South Jennings, there's a lot of blighted housing. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of rough nightclubs and bars. So it's a very small town, but it's an incredibly divided town.
You got chemical refineries and chemical plants. Is it polluted? Is it, I mean, I guess at least on that side of the tracks, maybe it is.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So interestingly, you know, one of the interesting sort of historical quirks of this parish is that neighboring parishes got this sort of goods as far as business, even businesses that pollute and the negative stuff that comes with that, obviously. So the neighboring parish to the west is Calcasieu Parish. And Calcasieu Parish has a ton of chemical and oil refineries. It's a very polluted parish for that reason, but it's got a lot of jobs also. So you have Calcasieu Parish to the west having that kind of business. And then to the east, you have Lafayette. And Lafayette also has a ton of oil jobs and sort of, you know, oil business employment. Jeff Davis is sort of surrounded by all that, but doesn't have really any of it.
So it gets the crumbs. So did this place have a reputation in Louisiana, even by Louisiana standards, as a corrupt place, or was it just really off the map entirely and off your map until this story sort of caught your attention?
Yeah. That's a good question. So Jeff Davis has mostly been off the map, you know, primarily because it's so, so small. You know, there's one big notable exception, and that is in the late 90s, Dateline went down there to do an entire hour about unlawful traffic stops and seizures in Jeff Davis. That was a hugely impactful show. I believe the viewing numbers were something like 12 million people saw it. And at the time, I didn't actually know this until I started researching this book. At the time, there were actually national calls to boycott the entire state of Louisiana based on this show, which is fascinating, especially because, again, you know, it was only about stops in Jeff Davis. There was somewhat a bit about stops in Calcasieu, but, you know, there was a national call to boycott all of Louisiana based on this show about Jeff Davis traffic stops. So that's really the one moment that Jeff Davis corruption has some visibility, and again, that's in the late 90s. Other than that, though, no, it's really off the map.
Well, that little piece of information about the traffic stops is pretty important to the backdrop of your larger tale about these murders, because I mean, as you describe in the book, the highway goes through there, and there is a lot of drug traffic. But the cops, at least the police agencies that you focus on, were way over the top in how they reacted and dealt with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. So one of the things that I should have mentioned when I was talking about the geography of New Orleans to the east and Jeff Davis to the west is that the interstate connecting all of this is I-10. And I-10 from Houston to New Orleans is a major drug trafficking hub. So drugs come in the port at Houston. They travel east through Calcasieu, through Jeff Davis, and then, you know, reaching their destination all the way east in New Orleans. So I-10 is this major drug trafficking hub, and the interstate goes right through Jeff Davis, which is so small. And one of the remarkable things about doing work out there, reporting, even visiting out there, it's remarkable. You know, you spend any time in Jeff Davis, you turn on the local news, read the paper, and you will read or see on the TV news about these, you know, just huge drug stops on I-10. So imagine being in small town USA, but then the news, your nightly news is 500 pounds of marijuana seized from a Toyota Camry, right, on the highway. So that's sort of the kind of contrast out there. It's incredible, and you know, the very nature of I-10 being such a big drug trafficking hub and going through this tiny parish creates all sorts of problems.
Yeah, I can imagine these small town cops who seeing all these riches, illicit riches, flowing through there on a daily basis, decided to grab a piece of it.
Right, and that's a part of it, and you know, another significant part of it. You know, and I quote the DA out there. You know, the DA, this is several years back of Jeff Davis Parish when he was running for re-election, said something like, you know, 85% of our cases or so are drug cases, yet we don't have any services for folks in terms of addiction services, rehabilitation services, and whatnot. So it creates these massive problems out there.
What drew you to the story? Then is it just the idea that there's 8 murders in this limited period of time, which is we'll talk about what that does to the murder rate for such a small community, but or the idea that it's unsolved, or the idea that there's a stench of corruption to it, or what?
So I first learned about this case in 2010, I believe, and it was a New York Times piece about the case that was on the front page of its national section. It was not a huge piece by any stretch of the imagination. It was a fairly standard newspaper piece. What interested me about it, though, was in this small space, the reporter mentioned a couple of things very briefly that sort of piqued my curiosity. One of which was there was a woman named Kristen Gary Lopez, who was one of the Jeff Davis 8 victims, and she was murdered in 2007. And the writer of the New York Times piece mentioned that a high-ranking investigator at the sheriff's office purchased a vehicle that may have been used in some capacity in the murder case, purchased a vehicle and then resold it and was disciplined for this. And I thought, that's really interesting. What a wild thing to happen, particularly given that I believe, you know, he mentioned at the time that it was a very high-ranking investigator, and it just it just sort of grabbed me that you know, at the time, it was the narrative about the case was that it was essentially a very standard serial killer case, but there were these other pieces to it, like this high-ranking investigator basically selling off a piece of evidence.
We're going to take a short break here. Ethan Brown is my guest, talking about Murder in the Bayou and one of the troubadours of Life of the Bayou. Hank Williams takes us into the break with his classic Jambalaya. We'll be right back. I had the great pleasure of seeing these guys perform live in New Orleans at Louisiana Treasure, the Neville Brothers, Yellow Moon from 1989. We're talking with Ethan Brown about his book, Murder in the Bayou. The general story is about the murder of eight women who all shared some characteristics in common. They were prostitutes. They dealt in drugs. They hung with a bad crowd. And you might assume that because of the similarities in how they were found, that maybe it's a serial killer. That is not entirely a scenario that sprung up on its own. It's been encouraged. Perhaps by some of the people who know the real story of who, how these women were killed and why they were killed. When we come back, we're going to get into a description of the victims, and then we'll discuss who might be responsible. Stick around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Ethan, you mentioned before the break that you first became interested in this case and this story after reading about it in the New York Times. And as you note in your book and people can see online, there's been a lot of national coverage about it. You have eight women murdered, similar circumstances in a tiny little town. It's a mystery, and a lot of the coverage, at least some of the coverage by national media, has sort of perpetuated the idea that maybe this was the work of a serial killer. As we learn in your book, though, that's not an entirely accidental process there that people come to that conclusion. Why don't you discuss that a little bit?
Right, it's strange. I mean, so on the one hand, obviously, this case has gotten a good amount of attention. It's been covered by the Times, New York Times, it's been covered by CNN. But really, the majority of the coverage sticks to this serial killer narrative. Primarily, I think, because the sheriff at the time of these murders, and they took place from 2005 to 2009, would give these odd press conferences every once in a while where he would say, "Well, we're not going to say it's a serial killer, but here are all these characteristics of serial killers, and look out for them." You know? So it's very odd. And then the other odd piece of this, particularly from the perspective of media covering it, is they're covering it as essentially a serial killer case. But what went unreported, oddly, most of the time, is that there were arrests in two of the cases. Both of the cases fell apart, but there were arrests in them. There was an arrest and indictment in the murder of victim number two, Ernestine Patterson. Two men were indicted on second-degree murder charges in her case. That case fell apart. And then there were arrest warrants issued in Kristen Gary Lopez, victim number three, for at least three people. And that case fell apart as well. So if you think that there was any substance to those two cases, even though they fell apart, then the serial killer narrative sort of implodes just with those two cases. Because in those two cases, you've got a minimum of five suspects, right? So it's interesting. It was covered as a serial killer case, even though procedurally, it was really never a serial killer case.
So give me the broad strokes. I mean, it's not a serial killer, but it is a series of serial murders in that you lay out the case in your book. They're all related. I mean, it is all related.
Right. So from 2005 to 2009, eight women were murdered. Their bodies were dumped in areas such as sort of back roads, canals, by crawfish ponds. So the commonality there is the method of disposal. And then there's another commonality, which is the way in which the coroner out there believed that they died. Asphyxia was suspected in 6 of the 8. In 2, they were stabbed to death. All 8 of the women, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say all, most of the women, most of the 8, were connected in some way. Victim Kristen Gary Lopez, victim number 3, was a cousin of victim number 7, Brittany Gary. There were other connections that I think are much more significant in a way that have really been unexplored. The major one being that most of the 8 had witnessed either significant law enforcement misconduct or other murders. For example, Kristen Gary Lopez, again, victim number 3, was interrogated in the murder case of victim number 1, Loretta Lewis. Victim number 5, Muggy Brown, was interrogated in the murder of victim number 2, Ernestine Patterson.
Do you think they were all killed because to keep them quiet, either about other crimes that were underway, their knowledge of them, or witnessing other crimes, or their knowledge of police corruption?
You know, I don't want to say that specifically. I just want to sort of point out the commonality. And, you know, because I feel like that broad of a statement might be painting with too broad a brush.
Okay.
I think it's much more safe to say, and it's more true to say that most of these women were witnesses to other very serious crimes, including homicide. And most of these women were witnesses to significant law enforcement misconduct.
At least one of the women, you suspect, participated in one of the murders.
Right, yeah. And you know, just to give one example, victim number 1, Loretta Chasson, a witness, a law enforcement witness, not somebody I interviewed, a law enforcement witness said that Loretta was having sex with a high-ranking member of the sheriff's department in the parish jail just before she was murdered. Other witnesses, and again, law enforcement witnesses, not my witnesses, said that the women were aware of a practice and sometimes engaged in this practice whereby women who were locked up at the parish jail would have sex with high-ranking members of the sheriff's office in order to get favors or get released from jail.
So 8 women murdered over that period of time in a community of 11,000 people. I can't even calculate what that murder rate is, but it is way off the charts. I mean, it's way out of whack. Even, you know, and even though the 8 were all prostitutes, I can see somebody saying, well, they, you know, what do you expect is going to happen in that line of work? Yeah, there are certain risks that come with the territory. But as I said in the introduction, I mean, nobody deserves this.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, and I should add to here that, you know, these women were, many of them were mothers. They were wives, many of them. They, you know, had families who loved them very much. Most, if not all of them, you know, had significant substance abuse problems. And when we talk about prostitution, we talk about sex work in this case, we're not talking about women who are engaged in high-priced sex work, or, you know, it's really the stuff of sort of basic survival, you know. But, you know, to your point about the murder rate and how this number of murders would affect a very small town of about 11,000, really, you know, the way in which this was framed by law enforcement, which is they even use the phrase high-risk lifestyle, you know, the way in which this case was framed allowed people, even in this very small community, to sort of marginalize the whole case. And the other piece of this that's very, very important, and it touches back to something I said a moment ago, I think before the break, about the divide between North and South Jennings, is that all eight of the women were from South Jennings. That's very important because South Jennings is the poor side of town. And I think these women being from the poor side of town marginalized them in a way that was much more significant than the fact that they may have engaged in sex work at one moment or another.
So eight women, all from the other side of the tracks, all of them involved in prostitution and drugs, get murdered. How far along into this, how many murders did it take before somebody said, hey, there must be a connection, or there might be a connection between these? We might have a serial killer in our midst.
That's a great question. So how far along does this go before somebody says, hey, you know, we should look at this differently, right, than we look at other murders? And the answer to that question is pretty fascinating. So in 2008, the woman who would become victim number seven, Brittany Gary, she's about 17 years old, actually, went missing. Members of her family went directly to the sheriff asking for help. Now, again, she would become victim number seven. There'd already been six victims to that point in 2008. According to these family members, they were met with total disinterest by the sheriff, and they then had to create their own search party to go looking for Brittany. They found Brittany in November of 2008, and she became victim number seven. Right around that time, law enforcement sort of wakes up, and they create a multi-agency task force known as MATE that is comprised of federal, state, and parish law enforcement. So it took basically until victim number seven for things to change out there as far as the way this case was viewed.
It was astonishing, too. The other common link for all eight of the victims is that all eight of them, not only were they prostitutes and drug users, they were all police informants. And that's probably right. A pretty key to the whole thing.
Right. I think, you know, although I should stress, I think, you know, the common perception of informants, I believe, is, you know, we have this notion of secretive people who work for the FBI, and sometimes that work might even be well-paid work, right? You know, we sort of imagine informants as you know, in the murky intelligence world of the CIA or the FBI or whatnot. But the sort of real day-to-day informants, the people who help the local PD or the local sheriff's office make drug busts, are just regular folks like these women. And these women would talk very openly with their friends and family members about this very kind of thing. They would talk about helping cops nab drug dealers. They would even talk about working on murder cases with cops. So they were informants, but not in the sort of traditional sense of how we think of them. They were more, you know, they were just sort of the kind of day-to-day sources of information for cops.
You know, every once in a while here in Las Vegas, you'll hear a story about a cop going too far, getting sexual favors from a prostitute. They get in trouble or fired or something like that. I was astonished at how much of it takes place in this book. And I mean, it's not just one or two officers. It's a whole lot of stuff. You have one character, and a law enforcement guy. He's now deceased, but he would cruise up and down the streets with his wife in the car and pick up prostitutes and take them home to a sex room. You have a warden who, according to at least multiple sources that you cite in the book, routinely had sexual liaisons with women who were in his jail. It's hard to believe that there's any other town in America where it's quite as common as it sounds like here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interaction between law enforcement and sex workers in this parish is very pervasive. However, what's been interesting to me to see, and it's surprising to me even after working on this book, is, you know, for example, this summer the Department of Justice released its report on the Baltimore Police Department post the Freddie Gray uprising or riot. And they found quite a few examples of cops, doing things like having sex with sex workers in their patrol vehicle. You know, we learned about that this summer. We also learned this year that there is a massive scandal in the Oakland area involving an underage sex worker known as Celeste Guap.
Oh, yeah.
Who allegedly had sex, again, the same sort of thing, sex in patrol vehicles and whatnot. And I believe that she alleged that she was trafficked by cops. And the allegations by Guap, are against a huge number of law enforcement agencies out there. So Jeff Davis Parish may be somewhat unique in its pervasiveness, but the fact that this is going on is not unique at all to Jeff Davis Parish.
Let's now maybe take a couple of minutes. We're going to go to a break in 3 or 4 minutes, but to introduce another central figure in your story, Frankie Richard.
All right.
He's a one-time pimp, a strip club owner, a drug dealer, meth addict. He did a muscle for hire, you say in the book, and he is—he has fingers in a lot of pies in this town.
Yes, exactly right.
So, describe him and how you gained access to him, because it sounds like in the book he talked to you quite a bit.
Yeah. So Frankie Richard, just to kind of go to the rudimentary fact of him in this case. By the time I started looking at this case, which is 2011-ish, he was already a prime suspect in this case. And in fact, warrants had been issued for his arrest and his niece's arrest in the murder of victim number 3, Kristen Gary Lopez. That case collapsed. Frankie is a Jennings native. He's a man in his 50s or 60s. He left Jennings for quite a while in the 90s and ran strip clubs in the Lafayette, Louisiana area. Lafayette's about half an hour east of Jennings / Jeff Davis Parish. Came back to Jennings in the early 2000s, and he was quite honest with me in talking about this. He talked to me about how he basically ran prostitutes in Lafayette, and he talked to me, and I know he's talked to other folks, about basically doing the same thing when he came back to Jennings in the early 2000s. As this sort of pimp figure in Jennings in the early 2000s to the mid-2000s. Remember, the mid-2000s is when this case begins.
I'll tell you what, we're about to jump into some good stuff here. We'll take a break here. Our conversation with Ethan Brown about murder in the Bayou continues in a moment. Roy Orbison takes us into the break with one of his best-known songs.